Well, good morning. I'm glad that you're with us today. If you've been here before, then you know we're in a series called Beyond the Flannel Graph. And so hopefully by now you know what a flannel graph is and you're familiar with it. If you don't know what a flannel graph is, it's these little felt pieces that go and they stick on other felt pieces. And when old people were kids and they were learning about the Bible stories, then they would stick these felt pieces on a board. They didn't have television back then. It was before television was invented. And dinosaurs roamed the earth, and children were learning Bible stories from pieces of felt. But we're going beyond the felt today, and we're learning stories now through things called television. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not, but well, we use these different methods now. But anyways, the reason we're calling it this, Beyond the Flannel Graph, is because we are taking the stories that we learned when we were kids, and we're taking those next steps. So we're talking about the full story, not just the cute parts that we hear when we're kids. And so far, we've talked about Joshua and the Wall of Jericho. We've talked about Samson and Delilah. We've talked about David and Goliath, and if you've missed any of these weeks so far, you can get caught up online. It's theproject.church, and you can listen to those messages there. So back when I was a kid, I had fond memories of those cute little Bibles that you used to have, and they still make them, right? My kids had them. And they've got these really cool stories inside of them of telling of all these wonderful Bible heroes, right? And so you get to flip through the pages, and they're artistic and cute. But as a kid, I had a pretty big imagination. And so, like, in my mind, I had these Bible characters, and, like, I had a certain image of each of those Bible characters, and they didn't necessarily match the pictures that were on the pages of the Bible either. And so when I was a kid and I was reading these stories, like, I had in my mind, like, cemented in the back of my mind, like, all of these different characters, the way they looked, the way they talked, the way they acted. For example, when I was a kid and I thought about Samson, the first image that would pop into my head was Hercules. Hercules? Yes, thank you. How many of you have seen Hercules? Hercules, Hercules. Can anyone tell me what year that came out? Disney Hercules. Oh, yeah, you're right. It's 90-something. You want to take a stab at it? 90 what? 97. That's right. You win a prize. I don't know what it is. I'll figure it out later. All right, so 1997. All right, so think about this for a minute. Think about the similarities here, right? They're both strong. They both have a girl that's trying to entice them. There's some, like, crazy, weird stuff happening where the girl's being forced to tell or do something against them to, like, remove their strength so they can be captured. Like, the similarities are so there. And so in my mind, I always had this picture of Samson as Hercules, and that's who Samson was in my mind, right? It was cemented in there. And so when you grow up and you start reading these stories for yourself, you realize pretty quickly that Samson was not Hercules, or at least the Disney version of Hercules. Not the same. They don't line up. Samson would not be a kid-friendly movie. This is probably why Disney chose to make Hercules instead of Samson, right? Because it was a little tiny bit cleaner than the Samson story. When I'm a kid and I've got these stories that are, like, ingrained in my mind, they're cemented in my brain, but now when I'm reading these stories, it's, like, messing with my brain, right? It's hurting my head. And so what I want to do today is talk about this story, but before I tell you what it is, we're going to try to guess what it is. So we're going to count to three. We're going to throw an image up on the screen. I want you to tell me what story we're talking about today. Ready? One, two, three. And Jonah and the fish and the whale, whatever you want to call it. Very good. Sorry, I had to put a mint in because I was, like, stopped up. And now I'm like crunching all over the place. So, so far in this series, we've progressed through, it's been interesting. We've progressed through the Old Testament and the different leadership styles from the nation of Israel. So we started with the story of Joshua, who was a leader of Israel. And then we talked about Samson, who was a judge of Israel. And then last week we talked about David, who was a king of Israel. And then this week we're talking about Jonah, who is a prophet of Israel. And so each of these leadership styles are important for God's plan. It's all just kind of, it maps out, and it's kind of this weird, cool progression of like the way that God led through people in the nation of Israel. But without strong leadership, the nation or the whole country, it failed God over and over and over again. So I want you to check this graphic out here. So this graphic's kind of cool because it's, no, not that one. That one. I'll probably put those out of order. Sorry, Roy. So the first one is conquest, right? So that's the story in Joshua, the one we learned about, and him leading people into this nation, this new home. And then we see Jericho, and there's a part of that story, and it's these leaders of Israel, right? They're leading their nation, but they're not considered a king. They're not considered a judge. They're not necessarily considered a prophet or anything like that. They're just leading their nation. They're people who connected with God, who made covenants with God, who brought the nation out of the sinful ways that they were living. So then we move on to judges. We were talking about judges, and Samson was one of these judges, right? And so in Judges, we see that these people, these warriors, these strong, powerful figures who are called judges are the ones who are leading Israel. And we see in the story, we see failure, we see cycles, we see faithfulness of some of them, right? And them bringing them out of this situation. And so then we see the kingdom. We talked about this last week. We see that they're united, that they're divided, and then all over again and again and again, we see these cycles happening where people, they rise to this throne, to the kingdom, to a king, even though God said you don't need a king. They wanted a king, and they got a king, and we see these kings, and they rise up, and they're faithful for a while. They unite everybody around them, and everything's fine, and then they fail God, and then everything kind of goes, right? And so we see this leadership style kind of progress throughout the Old Testament, which is kind of cool in conjunction with this whole series we've been talking about beyond the flannel graph. And so speaking of week number two, when we're talking about Samson, I think it's pretty interesting how each leadership style and the different responsibilities to the nation of Israel, each style brought something new to the table, right? And so we talked about cycles in week number two and the cycles that seemed to happen when it came to the judges. So throw up this graphic for me. So time and time again, we see the nation of Israel. And the nation of Israel, they sin, right? And then there's oppression that sets in. There's some sort of other nation or some sort of other group that comes in and they take over and the Israelites are in oppression. And then we see, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to do that, right? And so they're crying out to God, they're sorry, they repent for what they've done, and then we see deliverance happen, right? We see deliverance happen. And that's usually when a leader steps into the situation and they call out on the nation of Israel, on behalf of the nation of Israel, to God and say, God, we'll change our ways. And then there's some sort of covenant made usually between them and God, and then there's peace again until the cycle starts all over again. And what's interesting to me is it doesn't matter what leadership style they were in, if it was just a leader or if it was just a judge or a king or a prophet, this cycle seems to happen again and again and again and again with the nation of Israel. And yet, God's faithfulness continues. His mercy still continues. He still chases after the nation of Israel time and time again. And the story of Jonah is no different. but it presents in kind of an opposite style, right? They see this city of Nineveh, and they're living in this sinful ways, right? And we see that Jonah is sent there to talk to them about coming out of their sinful ways and obeying God. Well, what's interesting about the story is that Jonah is not necessarily on board with God's plan. So let's check out this video telling us all about Jonah's story.
Heroes of the Bible, Jonah. This is Jonah. Uh-huh. Jonah was a prophet. That means it was his job to tell people what God told him to say.
Yep.
One day, God told Jonah to go to Nineveh because the people of Nineveh were doing bad things. But instead, Jonah ran away.
Where are you, please?
And went to the port to board a ship, going the other way. He was hoping to get away from God. He sailed for a place called Tarshish. While he was at sea, God sent a great and powerful wind over the sea that caused a storm that seemed like it would break the ship apart. Fearing for their lives, the sailors tried everything they could think of to save the ship. Meanwhile, Jonah was sound asleep, so the captain went down and said, "How can you sleep at a time like this? Get up and pray to your God. Maybe he will help us." Then the crew figured out that Jonah was the reason for the storm. And they asked him, "Who are you? Why is this happening to us?" Jonah told them who he was and that he worshiped the one true God who made the sea. Then he told the sailors to throw him in the sea so the storm would stop.
"No, why?"
The sailors still tried to escape the storm, but it was no use. So they asked God for forgiveness and threw Jonah into the sea. The storm stopped at once.
Whoa!
The sailors were amazed at God's power and they vowed to serve him. Now God sent a great fish to swallow Jonah.
Great.
And Jonah was inside the fish for 3 days and nights. Jonah prayed to God from inside the fish, and God ordered the fish to spit Jonah out.
Yuck.
God told Jonah again to go to the city of Nineveh to tell them what God had said about them.
I get it.
This time, Jonah obeyed God and went to Nineveh to deliver God's message. The people of Nineveh stopped doing bad things and turned to God. They were saved because they listened to the message that God had given Jonah.
Yeah, so that's the story of Jonah that I know of when I was a kid, right? That's the one that cemented in the back of my brain that he was a hero of the Bible, right? A happy-go-lucky guy who ran from God because he was scared of an assignment, right? But he did it anyways because God saved him from the fish's mouth, right? The fish spit him back up. Well, here we are again. I'm going to crush your mental image of another character from your childhood. I'm sorry. If you need therapy after this, let me know. But I'm sorry to have to do this, but I have to tell you something. Jonah's not a hero of the Bible. He's not a hero, right? Sorry. Did that crush anybody? Did that hurt anybody's feelings? Yeah, okay, a couple of you. So this story that we just watched is the story that I have in my mind of Jonah, and that he's like this happy-go-lucky guy who just is trying to, like, he's just scared, and we all get scared sometimes when God calls us to do things. And so the story I was always told is, like, it's okay, like, God's going to call you to do big things, and sometimes you're going to get scared, and you should be like Jonah and do it anyways, otherwise you're going to get swallowed by fish. And it's like, okay, cool. But the actual image of Jonah now as an adult when I read this story is this. Can you throw this up for me? Yeah. grumpy, angry, upset. What are some other words that I could use to describe? Obstinate, just in opposition of what God is telling him to do. Doesn't he look angry? In fact, if you go to YouTube and you look up the Bible Project and you watch the video from Jonah, you'll see that they label him as the rebellious prophet who hated God for loving his enemies. The rebellious prophet who hated God for loving his enemies. So let's dive into Scripture. In Jonah chapter 1, 1 through 3, it says, "The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because it's wicked. Wickedness has come up before me." But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship and bound for the port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. So we can assume one of two things from this scripture, right? That either, number one, Jonah was scared of going to Nineveh because he was afraid of what was going to happen to him when he preached against them. When he preached against their sin, he was scared of what was going to happen to him. Or, number two, Jonah was not scared, but he didn't want to go because he didn't feel like Nineveh deserved to be saved from God's wrath. Either way that you look at it, it's not really very heroic of him, is it? So he's looking out for his best interest. Either way you look at it, he's looking out for his best interest. If he's scared and he's running from God and he's fearing for his life, he's more interested in himself than doing what God is asking him to do. Or he's so selfish that he doesn't want to see Nineveh saved because he himself thinks he knows better than God, and so he doesn't want them to be saved from God's wrath. Either way, he's running from God on a ship with sailors who don't know God. And somewhere along the way, they cast lots, or they toss dice or whatever they do to cast lots, and they figure out who is responsible. And when they figure out that it's Jonah, they ask him what they should do. And so this is what he says, Jonah 1, 12 through 16. "Pick me up and throw me into the sea," he replied, "and then it will become calm. I know that it's my fault that the great storm has come upon you." Instead, the men did their best to row back to land, but they could not, for the sea was even more wild than before. Then they cried out, "Lord, please, Lord, do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man, for you, Lord, have done as you have pleased." And they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At the men felt greatly feared the Lord and offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. Once again, we see that Jonah is trying to escape God's calling, right? Jonah himself could have cried out to the Lord and said, "Hey, God, I'm sorry. We're going to turn the boat around now, and I'm going to go to Nineveh, and I'm going to do the things that you asked me to do." That's not what Jonah does, is it? He could have done that, right? Like, God absolutely could have just stopped the storm, and they could have turned the boat around, and everyone would have been happy, right? What does he ask them to do? Throw him into the sea. What do you think Jonah expected to happen when he was thrown into the sea when there was a storm? He wanted to die, right? I would rather die than follow God's plan to go to Nineveh. Once again, we see that Jonah is not necessarily the hero that we thought of when we were kids. But God wanted to teach Jonah a lesson. And so now he sends this fish to swallow him up. So he's in this fish's stomach or whatever for 3 days, and then he's spit up on land. And so then Jonah's like, "Well, no matter what I do, no matter how selfish that I'm going to be, God is going to make me go to Nineveh, so I might as well go," right? It's like when your parents tell you to do something and you just, as much as you possibly can, try to not do the very thing that they ask you to do until they want to take away something that's like really precious to you, like your Nintendo time, and then you're like, "Oh, I'm going to go do that right now," you know? But Jonah finally agrees. He's like, "Fine, God, I'll go do the thing." So in Jonah 3, 4 through 5, Jonah began by going a day's journey into the city, proclaiming, 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. The Ninevites believed God. A fast was proclaimed, and all of them, from the greatest to the least, put on sackcloth. So when God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh to warn them against their wicked ways, what he tells them is 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. That's his message to the Ninevites. That's kind of scary, right? But he doesn't offer them any kind of ultimatum, does he? He doesn't say 40 more days until God destroys Nineveh unless you turn from your wicked ways and then God might save you. No, 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 no. Jonah just says 40 more days and Nineveh will be overthrown. I can almost see like the smug look on his face as he's walking through the city streets of Nineveh like, you're going to die and you're going to die and you're going to die and suckers, right? And it's almost just like he's like just trying his best to get his enemies, to get the Ninevites to die. It's crazy. So God is going to destroy you because you've disobeyed him. So the people of Nineveh, they cry out to God and they turn from their wicked ways. And God responds with this in Jonah 3:10. When God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he relented and did not bring about the destruction that he had threatened. So the Ninevites, they turn to God and they say, hey, God, we're sorry. From the least to the greatest to the king, they all begin to apologize. They all begin to cry out to God. And they're like, okay, God, we're gonna be better. We're going to do better. And God saw that it was good for him to have mercy on the Ninevites. He decides not to destroy Nineveh. Yay, right? This is a good thing. And we should all be thankful. Like, this is so good. Like, I think all of us in this room, if we had heard that an entire nation of people was not going to be destroyed, we would say, yay, that's great. Like, people's lives matter. And we should, like, care for every single one of them, not just one particular group of people, but for everybody, right? But Jonah, however, is upset with God's decision. He's upset with God's compassion for Nineveh. In Jonah 4, 1 through 3, it says, but to Jonah, this seemed very wrong. And he became angry. He prayed to the Lord, isn't this what I said, Lord, when I was still at home? That is what I tried to forestall by fleeing to Tarshish. I knew that you were gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity. Now, Lord, take away my life, for it is better for me to die than to live. What a jolly good character, right? Like, this guy is just so full of life and hope and love and No. Hey, but this does give us a clue. Look at this. It says, but to Jonah, this seemed very wrong. And he prayed and he said, isn't this what I said, Lord, that you were going to do? Right? When I was still at home, I knew when I was still at home. This is the reason I didn't come to Nineveh, God, because I knew that when I was at home, that you would change your mind and that you would actually have mercy on these people. And I can't believe that you would have mercy on these people. Right? And so I'm angry at you, God. I would rather you take my life than for me to be able to see them not be destroyed. Well, that kind of answers our first question, doesn't it? Why did Jonah flee from God in the first place? It wasn't because he was scared, was it? He wasn't scared to get on that, to go to Nineveh. He knew that God was going to save them, and he did not want that to happen. He knew that God was sending him, and the words that he was going to speak would change the hearts and the minds of the Ninevites. And in Jonah's mind, he thought, if I don't go to Nineveh, they're going to be destroyed because God said they're going to be destroyed, right? So he was actually fleeing so Nineveh would be destroyed. That's not very heroic, not at all. That's actually pretty messed up if you think about it. You see, throughout all of this, through this whole story, God is trying to teach Jonah a lesson. And even in this very, very moment where Jonah is just upset with God that he has saved Nineveh, God is still determined to teach Jonah a lesson in mercy. So Jonah is pouting outside of the city walls of Nineveh, and he's waiting for its destruction. He's like, he's upset with God. He's pouting on the hillside. And so God sends him a plant to provide shade for him. This nice little plant. He's sitting in, he's in the shade, and he's like, oh, this isn't so bad, right? So Jonah is thankful for the shade, but then the next day, God sends a little worm that eats up the plant, and the plant dies, and so it leaves Jonah sitting, pouting in the sun. Once again, Jonah gets upset and asks God, just kill me, God. Just kill me. Just be done with it. But God responds with this, and we see this is the very end of Jonah 4, 10 and 11. It says, but the Lord said, you have been concerned about this plant, though you did not tend to it or make it grow. It sprang up overnight and died overnight. And should I not have concern for the great city of Nineveh, in which there are more than 120,000 people who cannot tell their right hand from their left, and so many animals, right? So when it came down to it, Jonah wanted mercy from God. Jonah wanted the plant to remain so that he could have shade to sit on the side of this hill. But when God's mercy went away and the plant went away, then Jonah became upset. Yet all that Jonah could focus on for the city of Nineveh was justice. Jonah wanted justice for the city of Nineveh. Jonah wanted justice for himself. How dare you, God, take that plant away from me? Right? But then God's point here is that, Jonah, look at the plant. It was here today, and it was gone tomorrow. Look at this plant. It was here, but I can take it away as well. But should we not be more concerned about saving 120,000 people and all the animals inside of this great city of Nineveh than to try to save this plant that you're underneath pouting? Why don't you see that I want to have mercy on these people? And so, once again, we see that Jonah isn't really the hero of this story, but we see that God is the hero of this story, because this whole story teaches us a very valuable lesson, that God has always been more interested in mercy rather than justice. He is always more interested in restoration than destruction. But that isn't the way that we think, is it? When I was in college, I went to a church, attended a church. I worked there part-time doing just odd tasks for them. Started this college ministry. I started this college ministry, and I called it Munching with Moms. And the whole concept of this college ministry was, I was like, okay, well, there's a lot of people who are away from home, and they don't have their moms with them or their dads with them, and they don't get home-cooked meals very often because they're eating in a cafeteria. So why not have the moms of our church come and cook for these college students? It's going to be great, right? So we start this college ministry. The first night arrives. I'm thinking we're probably going to have like 15, 20 people. And we ended up having like 50 college students come. I was like, man, this is great, right? This is wonderful. And so kind of as we progress through and we're in the middle of this ministry, we end up with like 120 students in this thing. And so we eat together and we worship together and we do this little lesson together, short lesson together. And it is wonderful. It's going so well. And then the next year, we got a new pastor of the church. And the new pastor of the church, he came to me and brought me to his office. And he's like, hey, Matt, we're going to have to kill this ministry. Like, we need this. We need you to not do this anymore. Because we have a college ministry on campus, and we really want to support that college ministry, but it's really kind of hard to divide our attention. So we really need to cut cut munching with moms. And he said it very kindly, was very nice, very gracious. However, I was not real happy with his decision, right? Like that, it kind of hurt my feeling. This was my baby. This is something that I grew. This is something that I put together. And the other college ministry that's on campus, they don't even have half the people that we have coming to our college ministry. This is a terrible decision. And so I got hurt and I left the church, right? I left the church. I started looking for other churches. I found one. I connected with them. My story was fun. But in the process of me leaving the church, I was bitter, right? I was hurt. I was upset. I was angry. I didn't understand. I thought, man, he doesn't have a clue what he's doing. In fact, I can remember thinking at one point, like with me being gone, I thought, they're just going to fail. They're just going to fail, right? Like, I do so much for them. I do so much media work for them. They don't even know how to run the soundboard. Like, it's just going to fail. It's going to be terrible. They're not going to last another year. And ha-ha, it's going to be destroyed. And I'm going to get my last revenge, right? Like, I can remember thinking that. And like, looking back on that, I thought, how selfish was I, right? That I would wish that there would be another ministry that would fail because I wasn't there. How arrogant was I to think that I would be the one that if I step away from something, it can't succeed, right? In fact, the church began to grow after I left, and the pastor of that church is still there to this day and does a fantastic job with the ministry. And looking back now, I can see why he wanted to make sure that the college ministry that was on campus was successful and that the one that was happening at our church didn't need to exist, because I could totally see how he would want to engage students where they are, where they feel comfortable on campus, right? And so, like, now that I look at it, I'm like, how wrong was I? But in that moment, I was bitter and I was angry and I was upset and I didn't understand what was going on. I just wanted them to fail. Mercy. Grace, forgiveness, wholeness, not justice, not retribution, not trying to get even, not an eye for an eye. How many times in life do we do this? Someone wrongs us, or maybe we just don't like them in general. Maybe they talk too much. Or maybe they hurt somebody that we care about. And we want justice. We want justice, don't we? We want them to pay for what they've done. We want God to smite them, to smite our enemies. And he provides us with a nice shady spot on a hillside while we watch everything just collapse and go under, right? There's another prophet named Micah that tells us this. And it's what God is truly interested in. It's in Micah 7:18. It says, "Who is a God like you who pardons sins and forgives the transgressions of the remnant of his inheritance? You do not stay angry forever, but delight to show mercy." God delights in showing mercy. His heart is for retribution with his people. Jesus also echoed this truth through his actions. And Mark 3:1-6, there's a story here. It says, another time Jesus went into the synagogue, and there was a man there with a shriveled hand, and some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. So they watched him closely to see if they would heal him on the Sabbath, which was a big no. You did not heal people on the Sabbath. You didn't work on the Sabbath. That was not okay. So Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or evil, to save a life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed their stubborn hearts, said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and it was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians on how they might kill Jesus. You see, the Pharisees were obviously so focused on the rules, on the regulations, on the laws, that they were more concerned that that man would not be healed because they wanted Jesus to follow the law to a T. But what Jesus was more interested in was that man receiving a healing and believing in God and living a life that could be full rather than less than. Jesus was more concerned about mercy and about justice and about getting that man what he deserved than following the rules and trying to live this perfect life, right? You see, the Pharisees did not want to show mercy, but Jesus did. And through the story of Jonah, we see that Jesus' life is where God's priorities lie. Jesus is our example of how we can live a life that is full of mercy and grace. Which begs the question, are we so focused on rules and justice that we forget to show mercy to the people who are around us? We also see through Jonah's lives where bitterness and revenge leads to, right? Multiple times, Jonah said that he would rather die than see Nineveh restored. When we allow bitterness and anger to rule over our lives, to come into our hearts and come into our minds, it begins to eat at us like a disease. And we get to a place in our lives where we would rather die than live or die than see our enemies succeed because that bitterness has just eaten us from the inside out. And so the same is true in our lives. If we are so focused on revenge and hate and getting even, then we'll never have a life that's worth living. Forgiveness in our hearts creates a way for us to live a life that's full of living. In most of our flannel graph stories we've heard up to this point, we have seen that the heroes of the Old Testament, the reality is that none of these are truly heroes, right? They're just people. They're just people. They're just like you and I, right? They're just like you and I. That God is actually the hero of all these stories because God is the one that is consistent throughout these stories, finding a way to draw people closer and closer to him. In week one, Carrie read this scripture, and I've been thinking about it ever since. It's in Joshua 5, 13 through 14. It says, "Now when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, 'Are you for us or are you for our enemies?'" So he's standing there. He sees this man is obviously some kind of angel or messenger from the Lord. And he asks him, he says straight up, he says, "Are you for me or are you for my enemies?" And this is what he said. "Neither," he replies, "but as the commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come." He's not for us and against our enemies. God is for humanity, period, end of sentence. He is for all of us. He exists in a space where he wants to draw all people closer to him. Not just you, not just me, but our enemies too. In the New Testament, we see that God wants us to pray for our enemies. In Matthew 5, 43 through 44, it says, "You have heard that it was said once, 'Love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you." Now, why in the world would God want us to do that? Because he isn't against our enemies, right? He is for our enemies drawing closer to him. Why? Because when our enemies draw closer to God, they become more like God, which makes them not our enemies any longer. They become our brothers and sisters in Christ. Why? Because we are all the heroes of our own stories. But the fact is that we might be the enemy in someone else's story. It's a harsh truth, right? We just watched a story of a man who was obviously ready to see the destruction of 120,000 people. And we say, "Woohoo, Jonah's a hero," right? In the eyes of the Ninevites, Jonah was not the hero of the story, right? God was the hero in their story because he was the one who brought salvation to those people. In our own lives, in our own stories, a lot of times we fantasize ourselves as the hero of our stories, that we're the ones who people need to follow after, that we have all the answers and we're always right and we know all the things. But the reality is that there's probably somebody out there that thinks that you're the enemy of their story, right? That's a tough reality to think about. That God isn't against us. Don't get me wrong. God is not against us. He is for us, but he is also for our enemies, because God is for mercy. God is for mercy.